We're going to go now, however, to our first feature, which was Dr. Robin Walker, who's the past president of the Canadian Pediatric Society Section on Pediatric Environmental Health and a pediatrician himself. No surprise there. There was a fair bit of news the other day. It was 6 o'clock news, and I know it made it to, on the CBC and a couple other places, about a big meta study that had been done that declared, at least as far as the point of view of the reporters, that organic food was no better for you than kind of quote unquote regular food. Dr. Walker and I agreed that this was incorrect. Well, he's the one that said it was incorrect. We agreed that this was likely not due to any type of slant or spin, but just another example of why you should really support shows like The Green Majority, because a lot of the people who are just covering these things are just not. They're regular reporters. They have journalism degrees, but they don't have degrees in science or the environment or anything else like that. And they're just, you know, they just don't have the expertise to understand them. So we managed to find an expert who's gonna explain this issue for us. So take it away, Dr. Robin Walker. We'll be speaking to Robin Walker. Robin Walker is a pediatrician and past president of the Canadian Pediatric Society Section on Pediatric Environmental Health. My apologies. Welcome to the Green Majority, Robin Walker. I got an email in my listserv, one of hundreds a day that I get, but this one caught my attention because it was talking about a potentially misunderstood study talking about organic food. I've been coming across studies for years and years, and in some of my classes this issue came up again, where it seems like one study comes out and says that organic food is fantastic for you, the next one comes out and says that it's a total waste of money. So you had weighed in on how you thought that this, not that the study was incorrect, but that it had been reported improperly. Would you mind just describing a little bit what the story was talking about here?
Yeah, sure. So what I and other subscribers to this listserv had seen was one of a variety of news reports on a study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, which is a major medical journal, and that study was published earlier this week, and it was what is called a systematic review of the literature on the nutritional value of organic food. Now, a systematic review, just to make this clear, is a way to look at a mass of literature, a large number of research studies, and pool them together in a very systematic and sort of protocolized way, so that you can pull all the evidence from all of those studies together and try to come to some conclusions. And the reason for doing this is that studies often have different findings on the same subject, but if you put good studies together, then often the conclusions you'll reach will be more powerful than if you try to interpret the studies individually.
So just for clarity.
Sorry.
I was going to say, just for clarity, this is something where this comes up a lot with issues around like climate change, for instance, and so
on. Yes.
So just to be clear, this is the methodology they use is something like maybe like grouping studies that have similar methodologies and ranking them
Correct.
By authority
Correct.
And stuff like that.
That's exactly right. Now, one of the uses of systematic reviews, of course, is where conclusions are hard to reach and studies come up with different conclusions. And one of the problems often is that the studies actually don't have similar methodology or don't ask similar questions. So you can do a systematic review, and I have done systematic reviews myself. And sometimes it's a challenge to actually do that analysis and put them all together because they are actually all so different. And in this particular systematic review, there was some of that difficulty. So that can obviously affect the strength of the findings that come out of such a systematic review.
Okay, so what the story had been talking about that you and some others had said that you didn't entirely agree with was the idea that, and this you'll have to spill out for me a little bit, there's non-organic food had 30% more multi-antibiotic resistant bacteria, and non-organic food had 30% more pesticides. Can you break that down and kind of spread that out for us a little bit just so we understand what they're talking
about? Sure. And the point of debate here, if you like, was that the news reports concentrated on the study author's conclusion that their systematic review of the literature had not shown significant nutritional advantage to organic foods. But exactly as you have said, if you actually go to the study, or the systematic review and read the whole thing and read the author's own conclusions, there were two parts to those conclusions. They weren't able to show nutritional advantage to organic foods, but they did show significant differences in the levels of certain contaminants, as you have described. And so the question, of course, is why does one eat organic food? For some people, it might well be a belief that they are nutritionally superior. For others, it may well be that they want to reduce the risk of harm from these kind of environmental contaminants. And my comment to the listserv had been, I had never necessarily known whether organic foods were nutritionally superior. I'm not saying they're not, but certainly I didn't know of any evidence that they were. But I still felt that it was worthwhile protecting particularly my children from harm by using organic foods whenever possible, because I did want to reduce their exposure to pesticides, to antibiotics used in animals, and so on.
So I think there's a few really interesting parts here to break down. The first one I'd like to ask you about was I speak to many people who try and buy as much organic food as possible, and they all are pretty adamant about the fact that they can taste the difference, and it's very easy to tell when something's organic and when it's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So with things like this, where it, I mean, from a user end user point of view, it seems pretty easy to tell the difference between organic and non-organic. Why do you think, or why do you know why there's been such trouble kind of nailing down whether in fact it is more quote-unquote nutritionally valuable or not?
Well, one of the issues here is that you will only be able to assess what you measure. So what constitutes nutritional superiority? I've had a very nice dialogue as a result of this listserv conversation with someone who's involved in the organic food industry, and who made the point that most of the studies that look at nutritional value of foods look at only a very few components of the food. So, I mean, we know, you know, in the face of an obesity epidemic, that food that is high fat, high sugar, is not nutritionally as good as food that is low-fat, low-sugar, to be very simplistic. But when we're talking about the difference between organic and non-organic food, we're not talking about crude measures of that kind. You would have to start to look at much more subtle components, like, is there a difference in the richness of the mineral content? Is there a difference in the vitamin content? And so on. So most of these studies, in fact, the systematic review actually looked at close to 300 studies. Of those 300 studies, the vast majority looked at levels of contaminants or levels of nutrients, but the number of contaminants and the number of nutrients they looked for were really quite limited, and they were different in each study, which is one of the reasons why the study authors are quite cautious in their conclusions. And interestingly, to me, because I think the ultimate point is, does it make a difference to your health as an outcome whether you eat organic or not? Only three of the studies actually looked at any kinds of health outcomes. And those health outcomes they chose to look at were very, very short-term, mostly allergic symptomatology like asthma or other very short-term outcomes. They didn't make any attempt to look at long-term outcomes, which may actually be much more important when you're talking about environmental contaminants. For example, I've written on the link between certain pesticides and diseases such as cancers and leukemias and lymphomas, and those kinds of outcomes, of course, you can only see after very, very many years, even decades.
Right. So just, I guess, to give people a really clear example of what we're talking about, but why this is such a difficult area to study, is it, would it be fair to say this is similar as it would be similar to go to your doctor and say, am I well or not? And
yeah,
it's like, well, that depends
exactly
what you're looking at. You know, this, you know, how, you know, how much of this do you have? How much of that do you have? There's, you know, you can only find, you know, certain, say, viruses or certain disorders if you specifically know what you're looking for and go looking for it, and all these sorts of issues. Is that relatively the same idea?
And that's exactly right. And furthermore, what one always has to point out, and this isn't always easy for non-scientists to understand, is that absence of proof is not proof of absence. So if I can explain that, when we say that we don't have evidence to support a conclusion, that is not the same thing as saying that there is evidence that that something is not true. So when this study says they were not able, from this systematic review of the literature, to tell if the organic food is more nutritious than non-organic, that isn't the same thing as saying definitively that there is no difference. What it is saying is that on the basis of the currently available literature, they're not able to tell the difference. So we don't have proof that one is better than the other based on this current study, but until there are more studies that look at that richness of content of all the nutrients, we won't be able to definitively say that there's a difference in nutrition between organic and non-organic. We can't say at the moment that there is a superiority of one over the other, but that doesn't mean that it's proved that there is no difference.
Is that fair to say that's the sort of same difference as saying that it's the difference between guilty and not guilty rather than guilty and innocent?
That's a very good way of putting it, yes. Yes.
You know, we can say they're not guilty, but that doesn't mean that they're innocent, because you haven't established positive proof in the opposite direction.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that essentially is what the study authors concluded. They did not say that what they had proved was that there was no difference. They did say that on the basis of this review, they couldn't at this point in time ascertain that there was a nutritionally significant difference.
Okay, so you were admittedly not a nutritionist; you're a pediatrician. So falling more under your expertise is the other half of this, where we're talking about non-organic food being 30%. I'm not sure I understand that, because there's not supposed to be pesticides on organic food at all, I guess. But maybe you can make that out for me. But the idea of pesticides and pesticides being a harm specifically to children and developing bodies is something we definitely knew. We do know is definitely negative. So there's no question about that. Do you want to break down that a little bit and just explain what they meant by that 30% more pesticides?
Yeah, sure. And I mean, the issue here, of course, is that even food that is produced organically may not be totally pesticide-free. Let me put it this way. If a farmer in the next field is using pesticides and you're growing organic food in the next field, there's no guarantee that some of that won't come over, or that there will be pesticides in the water supply that you use to irrigate plants, and so on and so forth. So there's no guarantees that any food is totally pesticide-free. You can only say that food produced properly according to organic principles should be much lower. Now, certainly, as a pediatrician and specifically as a neonatologist, so that means a specialist in newborns, I am very interested in not only the long-term effects of pesticides and other substances on disease, but also on their impacts on development. So many of the concerns about environmental contaminants in the very young child are not only that they may predispose that child to later diseases, perhaps even in adulthood, like, say, cancers, just as an example, but also that they may have an impact on the development of the child's immature and developing organ systems. So to give a couple of examples of these two types of effects, we worry about the pesticide 2,4-D, which is very commonly used on lawns, for example, because there is, I think, fairly significant evidence that it may be associated with certain types of lymphomas, notably non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which tend to present in late youth or young adulthood. But as an example of the other approach, phthalates, which are used in plastics, have been associated with maldevelopment of the reproductive system, So they don't necessarily cause disease. They may do that too, but in this example, the concern in young children is also related to their impact on a developing organ system, in this case, the reproductive system.
Does that include stuff like bisphenol A that we've covered several times in the program?
It absolutely includes bisphenol A. Bisphenol A was banned from baby bottles in Canada. To our credit, was unusually the first country in the world to do that, although others have now followed suit, because of a concern about the impact of bisphenol A on development. BPA is an endocrine disruptor, and therefore through mimicking the action of human hormones can impact on the development of human organ systems. It may have other effects too, but that was the particular one that led the Canadian government to take this particular action.
Mm-hmm. And so with that, I mean, it's pretty much as soon as there was a lot of attention and Canada moved forward to ban bisphenol A, as you said, the same sort of groups that were following that, particularly groups like Environmental Defense, for instance, that it was spending a lot of time and energy working with that issue, had immediately moved on to something else, it seemed, no more than like 5 minutes later, about some other chemicals and stuff. So, I mean, we sort of hear about these contaminants and phthalates and stuff that get into that affect developmental disorders and whatnot. It feels like it's just one after the other. I mean, is there an endless list of these things that we need to one at a time kind of remove from our environment, or what's going on here?
Well, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, that is the reality. I was for a while involved in some of the committees that have been working on Canada's chemicals management plan. And I forget the exact number of chemicals that are being studied through that plan, but I think it's of the order of 40,000. So, you know, yes, the reality is that there is an almost endless stream of substances that we use nowadays in our daily lives, that industry produces for all kinds of purposes, and which can become contaminants in our bodies. And that's some of the complexity of studying this. First of all, you have this almost endless number, and even with all the scientists in the world, it's very hard to study every single one. And then secondly, you unquestionably will have some that may be perfectly safe and others which will have significant effects. And then thirdly, some of the effects that matter most in childhood are effects that won't become manifest for years or decades. And so studying to find a link between those later effects and the offending agent in childhood is incredibly complex.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, a lot of these don't present for quite some time, so you know, we may not even realize, you know, by the time we realize that something, you know, like bisphenol A, for instance, has been in baby bottles for years, not only is it's sort of too late to stop it, but you know, we have 30 years worth of children that have already been exposed.
Absolutely.
And so what is, I mean, is there any sort of sense of what a way forward here is, rather than, because I mean, it seems like, you know, we're sort of making the public aware of it and educators, both physicians and scientists and environmental activists are kind of bringing these things up one at a time and drawing attention to them. But it seems like for every one, you know, that's brought attention to it, there's 15 more that come out of the woodwork. So, I mean, is this a losing battle? Is there a better strategy? What's the way forward to deal with these sorts of health issues?
Well, and this takes us right back to the original subject of whether or not one should bother with the trouble and expense of trying to go organic in food. What I counsel parents on is that I'm certainly not one of those in the environmental movement who tries to suggest that everything is harmful, and that there is proof necessarily of that harm for, you know, 40,000 chemicals, say. But recognizing that some of them certainly have been shown to be harmful, and others that may not yet have been shown to be harmful very likely are, it seems to me to make sense to have a strategy whereby you avoid unnecessary exposure to chemicals, particularly for young developing children, wherever you can. And there are some very simple ways of doing that. There's a wonderful website that's produced by the Canadian Partnership for Child Health and the Environment, CPCHE, CPCHE, and if you Google it, you'll find it very easily. And they have a publication which basically gives you half a dozen very simple tips for how you can reduce exposure of children to potentially harmful chemicals. They know more than I are saying that these are all proven to be dangerous. They're simply saying that you reduce exposure where you can, and that's going to reduce the potential harm from these agents about which we still don't know enough. And one of those approaches, of course, is to consider organic food, not because it has better nutritional value, it may or may not, we just really don't know yet, as this study said, but because organic foods demonstrably, in the studies that have looked at this, do have lower levels of pesticides and other contaminants that may well be harmful to developing children. So that, to me, is a good reason for considering organic food if you have young children, even if we don't yet have the absolute scientific proof of the benefit.
It's clearly better for you in some respects, and obviously you described why the jury might still be out on some other respects, but I think it's pretty safe to say that we can say it's not bad for you. Is that fair?
Well, I think that's the point, isn't it? I mean, sometimes we are trying to make choices between, the lesser of two evils, if you want to put it that way. Mm-hmm. But in this case, there's not only is there no evidence that organic food might be worse for you, but it's scientifically implausible that it should be. So the possibility that particularly for a vulnerable population like young children, that it may reduce the potential for what could turn out to be significant harm seems to be quite sufficient of an argument to justify trying to go organic when you can.
We posted a picture on our Facebook page that we kind of had a clever idea around the, seeing as food has always been produced naturally, like the original food was grown was organic food. So why should organic food be the one to have the burden of an additional label? We should just call it food.
Actually, that's ironic, but it's a good point. And I mean, it also speaks to the irony that for many of these substances, the burden of proof really is sort of on those of us who want to suggest that you reduce harm to prove that they're harmful. As a physician, of course, I know that the approach to medications and therapies is that they have to be shown beyond, a reasonable doubt to be safe and effective before they can be put on the market. And yet for almost everything else, and certainly for all of these 40,000 chemicals, the approach has really tended to be, use them as you wish, and then wait for 40 years to see if someone can show that they're actually unsafe.
Yeah. Well, I think we've got a lot of work still cut out for us, Robin, but for now, thank you so much for joining us on The Green Majority. Again, that was Robin Walker, past president of the Canadian Pediatric Society section on pediatric environmental health and pediatrician himself. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.